For sure. It's like when they bring orphans into the dungeon.
What? Why?
Why did you bring the orphans?
Has this happened?
I care about them deeply.
Yeah, I care about them so much. I want to protect them.
I didn't trust them in that orphanage.
Checkmating your own DM.
Oh, yes, your move, DM. Will you kill the orphans?
Yes.
That's pretty fucked up, man.
Yeah. Wow.
I can't believe this right now.
That's why I don't put orphans in my games. It's just too, there's too much room for entrapment.
How do you yeah, do that? Like, whenever somebody's parents die, new parents sprout up, like, near their house?
We try not to question the ecosystem too much, but yes. Ah, he had an aunt on the other side of the continent. Let's get him out of this story immediately.
Welcome to Monsters and Multiclass, your Dungeons & Dragons fix. I'm Kevin Odie.
I'm Jared Bornigal.
And I'm Will Milk.
And we'll be hanging out with you for a while to talk about anything and everything D&D related. This episode we got two treats, a special Halloween episode, and joined by a special guest, Benjamin, the DM from the Lawful Great Adventures podcast. We'll be talking about curses and cursed items and all that spooky stuff, and then just a smattering of spooky monsters, skeletons, ghouls, gas, specters, ghosts, whatever else we kind of grab. So yeah, it should be great. Pull up a chair and stick around for a while.
All right, so before we get started into curses and everything spooky, because we're just like bad at setting hard topics for our Halloween episodes, I guess, just want to give Ben just a second to introduce yourself, talk about what your show is, and kind of establish some credentials.
Oh, yeah. Hey, I'm Benjamin. I'm the Dungeon Master for Lawful Great Adventures. We got started in February, and we've made a pretty big splash on the actual play scene. We are, and I apologize ahead of time, a Pathfinder 1st Edition podcast. I know I'm in 5e turf right now, but I do speak 5th Edition as a second language. The goal of our story is to have a character-driven experience, lots of lore, lots of narrative. Most of the humor we try to keep in-universe rather than, you know, doing goofs and pop culture references and that kind of thing. I clip a lot of fat out, so we might record for 2.5 hours and might only post 1 hour and 15 of it. So it's really dense, really narrative. It's a travel story about four friends trying to get across a continent that they had been, after they had been shunted away from home. So there's lots of world building opportunities, lots of like exposition, lots of learning. It's really fun. It's an absolute joy to make. We release every Thursday. It's weekly, which is, I can't believe I do that, but it is a weekly release schedule. And, you can find us at great_lawful on Twitter. You can find us Lawful Great Adventures on Facebook. I'm super active on the Twitters. So if you ever want to reach out and talk or whatever else, like, just go for it. I'm there all the time. I love this community. I love hopping on shows like this. I love talking about TTRPG stuff. So like, yeah, this is totally my jam.
Yeah, and we actually met, so not only through Twitter, though I kind of knew you beforehand. We were on the Plot Hook show together and did talk about travel. And you had some great insight running an entire show that's basically based on travel. So figured you'd be great to have you come on and talk about something completely different.
Oh yeah, totally. I will talk about all the TTRPG things. You don't even know.
Well, let's stick with just curses. And if you go outside of that, then you get like one warning, and afterwards we're just gonna kick you out of the Discord.
Oh, I was kind of hoping you would give, like, I would get a curse if that happened. Like, I would get cursed. I've always wanted to be.
We personally curse you. Go, we find a real world witch somewhere and have them curse you.
He says somewhere as if I don't have like 3 on speed dial.
Twitter's a spicy place, man. Yeah. You meet a lot of cool people.
That's a weird thought. Like a modern, like old school kind of hag witch, but modernized to use Twitter and cell phones. And you Venmo them your payment.
Yeah, she takes Bitcoin. Yeah. It's great.
All I heard is, you know, witches, and I'm having some career troubles. I'm wondering if maybe we want to talk about after the show.
All right, well, let's go ahead and get into the actual curse part of this. So I think it's important to start this whole broad conversation by really defining what a curse is. And so for the purposes of this show, I'm just going to state the 5th edition definition. And so that is that Some magic items bear curses that bedevil their users, sometimes long after a user has stopped using an item. A magic item's description specifies whether the item is cursed. Most methods of identifying items, including the identify spell, fail to reveal such a curse, although lore might hint at it. And a curse should be a surprise to the item's user when the curse effects are revealed. So, last thing is that attunement to a cursed item can't be ended voluntarily unless the curse is broken first, such as with a remove curse spell. So from that, we get a couple of important things that define what a cursed item is. The first thing is that the item bedevils the user, which means bad stuff happens. Most methods of identifying the item do not reveal that there is a curse. A curse is supposed to surprise the user when its effects are revealed, and attunement can't be ended voluntarily unless the curse is broken first. That's what a curse is. I'm just going to open it right there. What are your first thoughts?
I have like a whole rant. I can go into it if you want. I have like a whole thing. I typed it up for you. I sent
it to brief. You. Keep it brief. Keep it brief. Just to start.
So with cursed items, they kind of have the same problem as mimics, right? And what it does is the first time you introduce a cursed item, you have functionally changed the relationship between the dungeon master and the player for the remainder of the campaign and potentially for every other game that you ever run with any of those players ever again, because now they know that cursed items like mimics are in play. That is a tool in your toolbox. And what it does is, and this isn't necessarily a bad thing. This is not a condemnation. What I'm saying is what it does to sort of the meta level of the game is it completely changes the dynamic, because now there are certain things that they thought they could trust. For example, the identify spell or a very high arcana roll that they no longer can. And so, like, the first time they biff a roll on a trap, they're going to constantly be checking for curses with basically every item. So I recommend use with care. And then I have all sorts of stuff that I wrote down about cursed items and how I define them and how I use them. But yeah, that's sort of my basic thoughts is like when you put one in, you have thrown a massive wrench in the core dynamic of the dungeon master and the player relationship.
Right. Definitely. And one thing that I see as a major point of curses is that it creates, or there's a lot of leftover feelings from the adversarial DM mentality that was really prominent in earlier editions that, you know, 5th edition has done a lot to try and shake its way out of. But with a lot of the base written curses and cursed items, they still just have this type of like gotcha feeling to them that can be, as you mentioned, like really dangerous or just... You have to be cognizant of what you're doing when you are introducing them.
Yeah, for that reason, I really like the curses where it's a choice. Like going into it through lore and some research, you're aware that this cursed item exists, but the benefit is so damn good, it's going to be tempting to risk it.
Oh, yeah, totally. That's kind of my jam, too. And in fact, the DMG, I think it's page 139, Pathfinder, I think the 5th edition DMG, page 139, lists those kinds of curses, which are, they call them curses where there's like a hook attached, like they only work in certain situations, or you have to make some kind of a conscious sacrifice to them. And those are the ones that I think are the most fun.
Definitely, because otherwise you run into that issue where you're like, oh, hey, here's this cool item. The person gets excited, they use it one time, they figure out what the curse is, and then they go, oh, well, that's dumb. Let's go find a cleric to remove this curse and just move on with this. And that is when it's just like, you've just ruined the curse in general. Like, something that should and very well could be, like, this cool moment now just completely falls flat because the penalty outweighs it, and the ability to get rid of it is just way too easy.
Right, yeah, the remove curse spell is very, very... common, or a lot of them greater restoration, fifth level spell again, not hard to obtain. One issue with the option where the item is so good it's worth the curse is that's at least for the pre-written cursed items, and obviously you can make your own, but a lot of those are in artifact territory, so we're talking like level 20 stuff, like the Eye and Hand of Veshna. I'm assuming I'm saying that right. I know that's like a really...
Isn't it Vecna?
Vecna.
Why did I think it was Veshna? I know it's... Okay, Vecna. Doesn't matter. We don't pronounce things right on this show. You'll learn that about us.
where you get these absolutely amazing kind of campaign breaking abilities, because this is like a level 20 artifact basically, but it also attempts to overtake your character and possess and like take over its soul and devour it. And it's like, I mean, we're talking about like really big level 20 issues. For like low level campaigns, there's at least in pre-written stuff, there's not a lot that kind of fit there where the item is so good it's worth the curse. And I think that's hard to balance for lower levels.
I think they do create a pathway if you sort of read between the text, though. If you look at the cursed items that aren't the named ones, which are like, haha, these appear to be +5 armor class gauntlets, but actually they're -5. I got you. I finally beaten you. If it's not one of those, what they have is there's this table. I just love this. It was so cool. There's this table where it's like, okay, this only works underwater, or this only works if you swear fealty to a lord or whatever. So in my head, I'm thinking, okay, what I can do is I can say they're third level. I can throw an item in there that would be more suitable for to a fourth or fifth level character, but then maybe only make it work on a full moon. Or maybe there was one where it's like, oh, you have to burn 100 gold pieces worth of valuable items to use this every day. Or you have to sacrifice a 2,000 gold piece item to be able to use this. So they get a stronger item. They get a stronger magical item that is slightly beyond their what they would get at that level. But there's going to be some kind of a trade-off, which I think there's a lot of room in there for that to do. And it doesn't quite have the same, like, oh, you can't voluntarily unattune it, or it's not as cursed as it was before, you know, that kind of thing.
Right. And I think this really just comes down to the common complaint that, like, if the goal of your cursed item is to just have a gotcha moment as the DM, you're doing it very wrong. Because that is something I can do at any time as the DM. I can just say, hey, a rock just fell from the sky and squished you. Ha! Gotcha. I have unlimited power as the dungeon master. So there's no winning, or there's no like benefit to pulling one over on players, but offering them choice, offering them something that is now, as you said, either makes them feel powerful or it's limited in use, like whatever. I mean, it still gets that idea of a curse out there without it feeling like you're just trying to, again, screw over your players.
So I love that idea, and for like the sake of magic items where you have to spend something to make it work. It only works on a full moon, swear fealty, spend money, stuff like that. But I don't know if I'd call that a curse. Like, a curse is supposed to be negative. It's not supposed to be a trade-off.
Actually, when I was reading the thing, I was like, well, these don't look like cursed items. These just look like magic items with a hook attached. Yeah. Which, yeah.
That's fair. Unless it's like, okay, I guess then you can still have it be more of the limited times where it's bad, or like if it's, as you said, only works on a full moon, something like that could be like, oh, well, you know, on a full moon, you experience bouts of lycanthropy, but it's just going to be for one night. It's not permanent and it really sucks. But in that time, you get like a benefit of some sort like that. So keeping that idea of like, yes, it's negative, but maybe on that one day, like you can all plan around it where it's like, hey, we're going to go into this really tough fight. Maybe we turn John here into a werewolf just for a little, and we use that curse to our benefit.
We're just going to do a little, just a light lycanthropy here. I have something like that in my game right now. It's in the story. It's called the Seven Oaths Blade, and it's this sword where seven souls are trapped in it that have unfinished business. And as the party completes their unfinished business, the sword gets stronger. But every time it critically hits, roll on the wild magic table. Just whatever happens, roll on the wild magic table, and then that's what comes up, which can be good and can be bad.
Right.
Yeah.
So, Jared, one thing you said, I think I disagree with the concept where if a curse feels like a gotcha, you're doing it wrong. Because I mean, that's what a curse is. It's either
let me clarify before you even go any further. If that's the only thing you're getting out of it, then I think that you're doing it wrong.
Okay. Oh, like as a one time, like, you know, the cleric has a remove curse and like exactly one time in combat, this comes up and then they cast it and it's not a problem anymore.
Yes.
Sure. Yes. Yeah. I mean, at that point, why even add it in?
And I'll take this fight. I'll take this fight.
Actually, I did just, I'm ready for you. I did come up with a reason, but go on. Why?
Okay. There is, I think, space for gacha cursed items. I think there is a space for it. I think there is a space for items that you expect to do one thing, defy your identify and your arcana checks, and then do something negative that you find out at a horribly inopportune moment. And I think the best situation for those to appear would be in something like a mega dungeon. Something kind of where you are wholly dependent on what you scrounge from the single location long dungeon that you're doing, where, you know, things like suspicion and resource use and traps and all that are way more prevalent. And essentially it's, and usually those are a little bit more, I guess, on the quote game side, like they feel more like a really, really super complicated board game. But then cursed items add a new level of suspicion, distrust, and also forces the party to burn resources as they go through this dungeon, because they can't run back to town and get the curse removed. They're in a mega dungeon. That's kind of where I'm thinking. So you could have a thing where, like, okay, I'm going to say 5% of the magic items that they find in this dungeon are going to be cursed instead. So I'm just going to roll a d20 anytime I roll up a magic item, and we're going to see if it's cursed or not. And then that's just part of the experience. And the first time that happens is going to be great.
Yeah.
I think that's also a really good way to avoid what you said in the beginning, which was a great observation of essentially like setting a new standard for the relationship you have with your players. You can almost take a break from the standard relationship in some mega dungeons. You send out the message, hey guys, this is a wacky place and wacky stuff's going to happen. Be ready. Soon as you get back to town, the table's not a mimic. The bag of devouring is not eating your items. You aren't vulnerable to all types of damage for the next 5 minutes, but only on days ending in Y. You're safe. It's okay. We're good. We're friends. But when you enter the mega dungeon, we're taking a pause.
Set the tone by coming in with literal boxing gloves on and just take them off
at
the start of the session.
Now you can do it like the Brazilian steakhouses where you flip the red or the green thing over, and if it's green, they keep bringing you meat, but if it's red, there's no meat anymore.
Just come in and you just flip it, and then everybody's just a hush falls. No more meat.
Another good use for it, like just a complete gotcha that will only come up one time, is if the party's being betrayed. Build up, you have an NPC where you think they're an ally, you're going in some really big, momentous fight, they give you this magic item to help you out. You know, this is the key to it all, and it's cursed, and they knew that all along. And it completely screws you over, that encounter backfires, you have to run away, and they'll figure something else out.
I love that, and I have the counterpoint to it. The party discovers the cursed item, realizes that it's cursed, and uses it to trick a bad guy.
Okay, yeah. Get revenge.
I was thinking that as well. Like, you're right. Because once you have a cursed item and you do the remove curse, it doesn't remove the curse from the item. It lets you unattune from it. Now they have a cursed item, and it's kind of up to the players what they do with it. So I could see, like, it does get a benefit there, and it lets them become the betrayers. Say, like, hey, you know, we're like, oh, hey, to get out of this encounter, we'll give you a magic item. You know, you're obviously more powerful than us, so here you go. Here's this magical sword. And the person's like, oh, sweet, free sword, and I don't even have to waste my health, like, trying to beat up on these nerds. And then, you know, go their separate ways. Next time they use it, it's cursed. So there is some benefit to having these gotcha curses, that putting it in the player's hands, you know, it gets them once, they're like, ah, shucks, but... Yeah, fool me once, fool me twice, can't get fooled again.
That actually, Bag of Devouring is perfect for that. It's like the greatest robbery deterrent I've ever heard in my life.
Oh, yeah. And that's kind of the thing where you come down to the DM versus player mentality. If everyone is in on it, then it's cool. right? If everyone at the table is sort of in on the gag, like, oh, this is the spooky, scary dungeon master, and he's going to get us. Ah, you got me, dungeon master. Shh, gee willikers. You know, that can be fun. My tables are like that a little bit. There's always sort of a tongue-in-cheek, like, oh, man, Benjamin's being a real jerk face tonight. Wow. That can be fun if that's part of the dynamic. But if you're just kind of throwing them in there to be, I don't know, just kind of nasty, that can be a real problem. That can be a real breach.
Yeah, and a lot of that comes from the trust, like just knowing your group and the dungeon master. And it's like knowing, it's like, yeah, they're kind of being a jerk, but at the same time, it's in good fun, and they're not going to take it too far where all of a sudden it's no longer fun to play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like the first and only time I used a mimic, which it's not a cursed item, but it is a cursed monster. The first and only time I used a mimic, I told the party, okay, this is the only one in the world. You have found the last mimic. There are no more. I'm not going to use it again. That was once. I'm not doing it.
I think I did that exact same thing with our most recent campaign where you guys fought a mimic and I said, that's the last mimic for this entire campaign. I got my one,
right?
You know, but like, it gets so overused otherwise, or not even just, it's just boring. It just gets boring to be like, oh, I don't trust this chest. Is it a mimic? It's like, no, it's trapped with poison, but that you should expect.
Well, it's the same with cursed items. Like that you've almost punished yourself by introducing even one. Because what's going to happen now is they're just going to agonize over every little bundle of +2 distance arrows that they find. They're like, oh, are these going to go around the world and hit me in the back of the head? Ah, like
they are now. Wait, guy. That was hilarious. Like,
could you say that again? That was a pretty good taking notes here.
+2. Write this down. +2 distance arrows, but they go all around the world and hit you in the back of the head.
Yes, perfect. And everything in its way as well.
Oh man, that's okay. Now that's like an artifact.
Literal kingdoms that no one's ever encountered collapses due to the force of the arrow splitting a town in two.
So, kind of swapping a bit. I like the also really subtle ones. These are pure gotchas, but they're so subtle and the effects are so minimal where it's annoying but not going to really piss off the player. And I think that you could get a lot of use out of them. So, for instance, there's the lodestone, which is in Dead and Thay. Which I've never even actually heard of that until I saw this. I just pulled up the magic items and beyond. And so I don't actually know where this is, but it's a stone. It's a large gem that's worth 150 gold points, but it is cursed. When it's on your person, if you use dash or disengage, the curse activates. And until it's broken, your speed is reduced by 5 feet and your maximum load and lift capacities are halved. And then you become unwilling to part with the stone. And that's it.
Ooh.
You know, you place it in like a pile of gemstones and you say, yeah, that one's worth 150, that one's 200, that one's a 50 gold. And they'd gather it up, someone would gather up and throw it in their bag. Never think of it again until they go to sell it. And then now they don't want to sell it. You know, you could play it up like, oh, that's that one. Actually, you think there's something really special about that one. You really want to hold on to that one. It might actually be a really powerful artifact. So they don't sell it and this curse keeps going and it's just not so bad. The player's going to get pissed off. But it adds a little puzzle to figure out, all right, what the hell's going on?
I like that a lot. That's actually one where I would get the player in on it. Like, I would, the first time it activated, I would send them a little private message. And I would be like, oh, by the way, you never want to let this stone go. Play along, buddy.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Yeah.
And then it's a puzzle where the player is like in on it. And then the puzzle is the party trying to figure out like, why doesn't he want to get rid of this freaking gemstone?
Right. For the record, that's a Yawning Portal, which is the tribute book to all those classic dungeons.
Oh.
And if anybody isn't aware, that's the book they adapted the Fuck You Dungeons from the olden days.
Nice.
So all the magic items in that curse.
Right.
Every trap, instant death. It's a slept on book because people in 5e are just, they're not hard like they used to be. But I care about this character. It's like, oh, you shouldn't have rolled a 4.
And in a similar vein, there's the Stone of Ill Luck, the hidden shrine of Tomachot. I don't know if I'm saying that right. That also might be from same book. I'm not sure.
I don't need the lore on it. It's fine.
It masquerades as Stone of Good Luck, which adds a plus one to basically every one of your rolls. And that's how the character will do it. But it actually does a minus two penalty. But it instructs the DM to just secretly do that for the player. And then that's it.
That's the whole curse. That's how I like to handle all my cursed items that just move the number the other way. Like, there's the I think they're the Bracers of Armor minus five. Like, just wondering how long it's going to take for the player to notice, like, oh my god, I keep getting hit. I have an AC of 15. Why do I keep getting whooped on? And then maybe they'll trace it back to the Bracers. That can be fun and interesting. I think if it went on too long, I would get sick of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd give that one about a two encounters before I'm like, it's the Bracers. Come on, like, put two and two together. That said, I roll in the open, so like immediately they're going to figure out what the plus to hit is for the enemy and be like, but I don't understand. Why do you keep rolling a different plus to hit for them or for when you attack me compared to everyone else? So that probably wouldn't work out too well.
I think that's actually exactly how it would work best, because then the players are like, oh, wait a second, something is amiss. And then that actually feels more fair than if you were rolling behind the screen to me.
Right.
Yep. You're right. Cause if it's not behind the screen, they're just going to think that the DM just keeps getting these crazy lucky rolls, which does happen. So
yes, it does.
Or something like the Stone of Ill Luck, since it lowers the player's roll, it would have to kind of come out over time, where there's plenty of times where you roll to hit somebody and the person before you rolls, oh, I rolled a 16 to hit. Like, yes, that hits. And then the next person rolls, oh, I also rolled a 16. Actually, you miss. Crazy thing. I don't know. You just miss, man.
Sorry about that. Yeah. My B. I don't know what's going on. You got to switch them dice out, I guess. Yeah.
The same number.
Sorry, your 16 is no good. Isn't here, my crazy? Bad, man.
I just checked. It didn't hit. Sorry, man.
And then you would have to play up the description where just something feels off. You just keep getting unlucky breaks. You're not sure why. You know, stuff like that.
Oh, yeah. I would have them, like, randomly trip upstairs, maybe. Or, like, you know, like, I feel like the just a little bit of bad luck would sort of, like, you know, carriage. They're in the back of the group. Group crosses, carriage runs by, splashes them. You know, I would be like, you got splashed on. I would just sort of, because I feel like there would be other little tiny manifestations of bad luck, and maybe they would catch on.
That's a good point. Yeah, and I think really swinging back to that stone, you said that, like,
lodestone
just comes up when you dash and things like that. Just little curses that don't ruin the character. Mm-hmm. I'm totally good with, like, throw them as often as you want. Well, okay, you know, throw them in at least every once in a while. Don't get carried away. But I think those ones are at least interesting, because there you said it's like, well, it's ruining your dash action. So every time you dash now and try and run further.
Well, no, like, it activates the first time you dash or disengage when it's on your person, and then it's permanent.
Oh, then it's permanent.
But it's
oh.
minus five movement speed. Which is annoying. It's annoying enough to drive the character or the player to really look into it. Because you're going to have to keep correcting them. It's like, no, actually, you're not sure right. You just feel sluggish and weighed down. You only get 25 feet of movement.
Yeah. Okay. So then maybe that's it. Just the things that are just like oh so subtle that aren't going to matter, you know, 99% of the time. But the 1% when they do, they just go, oh, right. Why the hell is that happening?
Right.
I had one I had one curse. This is just a curse, not a cursed item. But I had one curse where the curse was the character just couldn't say the big bad guy's name. That was the curse. He couldn't say his name. And what it was is it was a transmissible curse that his, like, spies and agents had to be afflicted with. Because, like, if a spy for this bad guy, his name was Gifre Hellstrom, and, like, if one of his spies got captured and they were, like, getting beat up, and it'd be like, who do you work for? And they'd be like, I can't actually tell you. And they're like, don't worry, we'll protect you. No, I literally can't tell you. I have a curse. So it got transmitted to the player. It barely affected his gameplay at all. He just couldn't say Gifre. And it was, I think we carried that for probably 6 months of in-game time. And it was the most frustrating thing, because anytime he would try to say Gifre, he actually got really good at role-playing it too. He would be like, oh, I can't say it. The guy we hate, that guy.
Yeah, yeah. That's yeah. awesome. And I could totally see just like, even just saying like, well, that's not really worth expending the resource. Sorry. Just, you know, deal with it. Like from a totally like in game perspective, just like, look, every day we seem to fight these crazy things. I'm not about to just go wasting money or wasting whatever just because you can't say the bad guy's name. When is that going to be a problem?
I
like being a dick to my other players.
There, I remember like one time I actually managed to make it a problem, and he had gotten separated from the party, and it was really important that he be able to identify the bad guy to some important NPC, and he couldn't, and it was awkward and beautiful.
Yeah, that's great. That's fantastic. So, as I was kind of looking through less on the official cursed items, one suggestion that I saw I really liked, and it was the idea of needing to hit certain thresholds of things happening in order for negative effects to trigger. So, to give an example, let's say that a item restores HP, and at first when you attune to it and start using it, it just restores HP in whatever its normal fashion is. Say, expend a charge, get 10 HP. Great. But as you use it more and more, more of the curse starts to come out. So, okay, it's been 50 HP that you've healed. Now that you have gotten to that threshold, some negative effects happens. Your speed is reduced by 5, or your constitution goes down by 1 because you're like, you know, tapping into your inner essence and you're actually pulling that out and shortening your life because of it. And so then you get to 100 and now it, you know, more negative effects happen. And as you use it more and more, you start to, you know, figure out more of the curse and actually have all of the effects come out. So that was like step one of like a really neat way to do the curse so that it's not all out on the table right away. Because if you just start it where it's like every time you do this, you go down a point in constitution, they're going to do whatever it takes to get rid of that item. But if it's like a slow burn, you're going to have that question of, well, how long can I keep pushing this before I don't want it to happen anymore?
Oh, I love that. Mm-hmm. I love that, especially if you're in a game where that item sort of fills a hole in the party.
Yeah,
like it might not. Maybe you don't have a cleric, so this is like a really cool healing item. Awesome. Or like maybe you don't have a rogue, so this is like a magical lockpick that also saps your energy or something. Like that's right. Yeah, I love that. That's so cool.
Yeah, and so I really liked that. And then to take it a step further, I think that, well, I guess it's also pivoting, is that cursed items really should carry some lore to them, or at least the like most interesting ones that you want to keep around for a little bit would be great if they have lore. So I like the idea of as that resource accumulates, you find out more from this item. So maybe you're getting like visions from it of like what happened to make this thing cursed in the first place. So as you get to like 25, you as the DM go through and describe a bit of history to it that the player gets in a vision. So now it's not just an item that they have some connection to it. And then at 50, when they start getting these negative effects, they're like, oh, but this is like an item that I know some history about and like have a connection with. And as you build that up more and more, you kind of reveal again how the curse happened and maybe like a way to get rid of the curse and still have the item work properly.
Yes. I'm imagining like a little marble bleeding statue, and you can like use some of the blood to like heal wounds. But then like at a certain threshold, you sort of learn about the history of the martyr and some of the magics enwrapped in the statue. And then like maybe after like 100 hit points and you've taken all of these like negative things and you're just getting your butt whooped by the statue, you get a hook for a side quest that might be able to cleanse it by like, I don't know, finding the burial site of this martyr and laying her to rest or finishing her business. And that,
exactly.
That's awesome. I love
exactly.
that. I love that. That's so,
so
cool.
You get to go. So then, you know, and once it does become almost like too much for the player to deal with, and so they're like using it less or whatever, like now it's enticing them to use that cursed item more because maybe there's more lore tucked away and more like clues that they can get out of it. And yeah, it just keeps building.
Yeah, definitely a ton you can do with that. And it's always great when cursed items, magic items lead to quests instead of just being an item that you interact with. Remove curse on it, you're done, you know, whatever.
Right. Though I could imagine, like, you might find cursed items if you were, say, raiding a wizard's academy. And you go into the enchanting room, and there's all these cursed items made by the students. And
they tried making just, like, normal items and just totally whiffed.
Yeah, yeah. They're terrible. But, like, maybe one of them is awesome, but the party would have to, like, figure out which one. That could actually be a really compelling dungeon crawl. Like, the party is searching through these cursed items because they found out that, like, one of them was accidentally this amazing artifact. But the only way to find out is they have to try all of them.
It's like the Holy Grail in Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
All of these except for one will melt your face.
And you know they're going to try. They're going to pick up the first one that they see and swing at something just to see how bad can it really be.
I would wear as many as possible. I would just lay them all on. And if I die, I die.
So when you first set a threshold, I thought you were going another direction, which I think could also be interesting, where the cursed item needs to be appeased in some way. Otherwise, then the curse comes out, and it's kind of this burden the players to keep going. I already written one, the Sword of Kos, which is like a high-level crazy artifact. It does all this ridiculous stuff, but it has one aspect where if the sword has been released from its scabbard, pulled from its scabbard for 1 minute, and has not been bathed in blood within that minute, you need to make a DC 15 charisma saving throw. If you pass, you still take psychic damage. If you fail, it casts dominate monster on you. And that lasts until the sword has become bathed in blood. So that's like really crazy high level stuff, but
just for clarification, when it says bathed in blood, I mean, like,
I'm assuming like basically kill somebody. That's what I'm getting at. Plunge well, okay, through somebody. That is that's how I would
it's
take
still,
it.
It's an important distinction because if it's saying you have to kill somebody, then I could see like going through a combat and like you don't actually end up killing somebody or don't get like the final blow. And so now you're just like, what do I do? My sword's about to go berserk. And that would be like, well, good thing I keep my bag of rats around.
I think
it's always a bag of rats, man.
So the sort of
you gotta be Cerberus.
Like I said, it's a high level artifact that is directly connected to Vecna, and it's
artifacts are like universal. This has a story. This is a one of a kind. Don't give this to your party unless it's the end of the quest kind of thing.
Right. And yeah, it has this whole thing. The Sword of Kos is the only thing that could kill the and destroy the eye in hand of Vecna. There's basically already a pre-written story connected to those two. So they for that one specifically, various reasons to
I was just thinking that the weaselly wording must be bathed in blood is actually sort of to its benefit because like if you look back to like stories and fairy tales and like Arthurian legend and stuff, it's full of things where the hero wins because they sort of hack the curse. So imagine, you know, you're going into this dungeon crawl, you think it's going to last 6 days. So you bring six hogs with you and you've just got them as a backup so that once a day, if you have to, you can slaughter a hog, bathe this sword in blood. And that keeps this demon at bay so that you can use its full power and defeat the monster, but you aren't at risk.
It also gives you a resource that you now have to protect.
I love that. That's my favorite thing.
I see six hogs walking behind you, and hey, they're with the party too. Why not kill them? So, you know, you're 2 days in and you're like, it's fine. I got four more hogs. I can keep this going. It's like, nope. Actually just killed three of them. You've got one more day of this. Sorry.
Why kill the hogs when you can have them just sprint off into the dungeon?
Sure, that too. For sure.
Here's all different directions.
You bring six hogs. You number them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7. You let them loose in the dungeon, and the goblins will be too busy looking for hog number 6 that you can ambush them.
How didn't that work?
First,
I don't think it was in Goblin, man. I don't know if they know the numbers we use.
First, though, you have a wizard cast grease on the pig. No, that would be good, though. You're right. You just have, like, Will, as you said, just have them run off. Just like, yeah, you're... Because PCs are... They're smarter than that. Let's give players some credit. They're going to attach them to a rope or something and lead them around. But that still gives you a lot to, like... Just ruin that. I would literally have a wizard cast grease on those pigs and set them free because that's hilarious.
Well, and player characters, especially you get into the mid or high levels, get pretty freaking strong anyway, that like giving them a resource to track, or rather when they volunteer themselves a resource that they have to protect, oh, that's just the best drama. That is yeah. the best stuff.
For sure. It's like when they bring orphans into the dungeon.
What? Why?
Why did you bring the orphan?
Has this
happened? I care about them deeply.
Yeah, I care about them so much. I want to protect them.
I didn't trust them in that orphanage.
Checkmating your own DM.
Oh, yes, your move, DM. Will you kill the orphans?
Yes.
That's pretty fucked up, man.
Yeah. Wow.
I can't believe this right now.
That's why I don't put orphans in my games. There's just too there's too much room for entrapment.
How do you do that? Like whenever somebody's parents die, new parents sprout up like near their house.
We try not to question the ecosystem too much, but yes. Ah, he had an aunt on the other side of the continent. Let's get him out of this story immediately.
No, they're one of the most valuable resources, so I like to keep them around.
We're talking about cursed items, right?
Cursed players.
Cursed players now.
That was a total derail. I like it.
Oh, that was outstanding. That was very good.
So,
all right. So, oh, go ahead.
It's another direction you can take with cursed items. Again, this is on the really high artifact level where you kind of almost make the entire campaign around dealing with this evil cursed artifact, where it's like the Wand of Orcus or it's just something you made up for. You know, an artifact of a greater demon or devil or whatever, and it needs to be destroyed. I mean, so basically you're pulling directly from Lord of the Rings, which is what D&D is based off of, and so it's probably fit very well. And I know there's like different, I don't remember the specifics, but I've like artifacts where the only way it could be destroyed is if someone's been attuned for it for like 100 days, and after those 100 days, if the person wants, they could destroy it. But during those 100 days, it's sentient and they have to keep making charisma checks to not get corrupted, and it saps their strength and has all these negative effects and things like that. And it's like if they manage to survive it to the 100 days without being corrupted and over influenced by this like horribly powerful thing, they could destroy it.
That's really cool.
That might be a little hard to fit into like a standard kind of heroics D&D game. Like, oh, let's go to the town and I'll clear out your goblins for you. Oh, yes, don't worry about the decrepit guy in the back who keeps muttering insanities to himself. He's working on this weird thing with an artifact. He'll be fine. I mean, so it could get a little weird, but...
That'd be a cool climax to like, that'd be a great like fourth or fifth act in a major campaign. Like you get to the high level thing, they've got their keep, they've got their thing. They realize like, oh, and then they find out how to defeat the artifact. It's like, oh, all we have to do is attune to this thing for 100 days. That doesn't sound so bad. And then the last like leg of the campaign is realizing just how bad of an idea that is.
Right.
Like, I think that's really cool and compelling.
Yeah.
One of my earliest, the first level 1 through 20 campaign that I ever ran was the party collecting the shards of an artifact. And the artifact gradually got more powerful the more shards they found. And the influence that it held over the party members that were holding onto the shards also increased. So they get to the point where they have 4 shards. So each of them is holding 1 shard each. Then they get the 5th shard about halfway through the entire campaign. 4 members in the party. So the big question is, okay... Who's going to hold 2 of these? And that was like a whole deal. So they're like trying to exchange it and then they're getting more and more. And it's like, and it's gradually wearing them down and making them weaker. And, you know, there's chances that their alignment might gradually start turning. Like the shards will be like, oh, if you do this, I'll leave you alone for the day. But what it's asking them to do is kind of like naughty.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool. That's really cool.
Yeah. I like that a lot. Cause that gets the whole party involved. It's not just like one martyr of the party, because then you kind of get like main character syndrome issues if it's one person that has to put on this artifact.
Or almost the opposite to some extent too, if they just like keep on having, if they're so debilitated from whatever this curse is but they need to keep going, it's like all right, well, we're gonna have this fight. You're gonna die, so please just sit in the corner. You're an NPC now.
Well, and I think there was a situation where like one character really needed to accomplish a task and he knew that carrying the shard would make it more difficult to do that. So the other character was like, okay, I'll take it for a little while. I'll hold on to it
that's
for
awesome.
You. And that's going to suck because then that was their first experience holding 2 at once. And they're like, oh, this actually sucks way worse than I thought it would.
Yeah. No, that's great. But what they should have done was actually get a couple hogs and just stick the shards. This is why I'm not a player.
I love it.
Like, wait, why are we holding on to these things? Let's just give them to some pigs. But no, that's really good. And again, you're bringing in that aspect of choice now that is making the curse actually interesting. Or I don't know if you called that a curse when you did it, but it is. I mean, it fits all the criteria, basically.
Yeah. I mean, the wider you make the cursed item umbrella, the more stuff you can fit under it, obviously. But it's right. But it's not just this thing was supposed to do this, but it actually did the opposite. Haha.
Yeah, no, you're totally right. Which actually brings me to another question, which is just around that. Like, in fiction, often a curse is something that's like a burden to bear of some sort, where like a destiny is determined to break the holder of the curse down, which is like exactly what you just described. So this is perfect. So how can you take that concept and work it into a D&D character where it's more like their destiny that is cursed, that or the party as a whole is cursed, when destiny in D&D can be a little bit fickle with dice rolls and random deaths and yada yada yada?
Yeah, just in general, that stuff I feel usually does not translate to D&D. I mean, it's so common within any fantasy story, the prophecies and the chosen ones, that people like to try and incorporate it. And then, yeah, you're level 2 and your goblin crits on you and you die, and that's that. It's like, oh shit, it's all of it gets thrown out. I haven't figured out a good way to kind of translate that stuff.
It's, yeah, that is a challenge, because, you know, the advantage of fiction is that you know the ending when you've started writing, where, right, you know, the magic of a tabletop role-playing game is that you ideally, you don't know the actual, like, details of how the ending is going to go out. You might have sketches, but you don't know, like, oh yeah, this character is definitely going to die from this.
Right, right. And I think it actually, it works better with, like, what you described, where it's more of that an artifact is cursed. Something that is independent of the players has this curse, and anyone who has this cursed item is destined to do X, Y, and Z, and it's going to be just, like, when they have it, they will, I was about to say, just start being sad, but that's crazy. It should be that they start going crazy.
The regular sort of feeling pretty bad about yourself.
Yeah. I think like, I own that sword. Yeah,
I don't feel any different. Actually, I feel a little bit better.
I did incorporate a curse like that at one point in that same campaign with the shards. There was this legend about how the Lich King was slain by this blade that could only be held by someone who had never touched evil or who had never done an evil thing in their life, or who had not a shred of evil in them. That's how I worded it. Didn't have a shred of evil in them. So this dude, he's a gray figure. He's the rogue. He gets this curse where I stole this from Iron Man, sorry, not sorry. There is a little shard of iron right next to his heart that grows whenever he does a bad deed. And this is one of the players. So, like, whenever he does something, like, evil, he's got this curse, and it's like, oh, you feel a little twinge in your chest. He's like, oh, did I do a bad thing? It was a fun dynamic. We worked on it. We collaborated on it. What this curse was that little shard of iron actually was compressed evil energy. He finds this out. So then they're in this big confrontation in the room where this legendary blade that can only be held by someone without a shred of evil in them is kept. And what they do is some kind of a magical effect that literally rips this shard of iron out of his chest. He takes an unbelievable amount of damage, but then for a very short period of time, he's able to hold this sword because technically all of the evil has been excised out of him. Does that, grabs it, kills the bad guy. Pretty cool.
Yeah, that's really awesome. Was that kind of like the plan with that? Or was that just like, you know, kind of worked out? Or were you just like, hey, here's this sword. You have to not have a shred of evil. You all figure it out. And that just the cards kind of aligned.
Little bit of column A, a little bit of column B, a little bit of the campaign. Yeah. It was 10 years ago. I don't exactly remember how it played out.
That's fine.
I do remember the feeling at the table was, oh my God, that's right. Right. That's how that works. So everyone was really into it.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So I think that actually goes back to something you said earlier, is that when you're kind of vague with your curses or your legends or whatever, it leaves them so open for interpretation that it can surprise even the person who created it in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man.
Is that it on curses, guys? Are we done?
I feel like we have plumbed the depths.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, no need to push it any further.
I had like one thing that I wanted to say about spooky monsters.
That's cool, man. Yeah. What's give me the spooky monster rundown.
Okay. So all I was going to say about spooky monsters is that if you are having a hard time finding really good, flavorful spooky monsters, dig into the Pathfinder bestiaries. There's six of them. And like all of the undead in the Pathfinder bestiaries are super flavorful. Like almost all of them have like, oh yes, this spirit appears when a serial killer is murdered by hanging by moonlight. And then it creates this kind of undead. So like every single like little kind of like spirit or undead or whatever, this is the strongest part of the Pathfinder bestiaries, is how they handle these like cursed enemies and these undeads. Every one of them has some kind of a hook attached to them that you can write. Like, you can just, like, you walk into a town and they're dealing with this, and then you can just write a monster hunt based on that from there. And it's generally fairly easy to port over to 5th edition if you know a little bit about how 5th edition monsters are constructed and how to tweak the numbers, in my opinion. But, like, yeah, if you really need some solid flavor, the Pathfinder bestiaries have, like, awesome, awesome, awesome spookiness. That's cool. All I was going to say.
Nice. That's really good info. And that reminds me of that, to some extent, that recent game. I just bought it on it's like a Ghost Hunter game that just came out recently.
Phantasma something, Agoria?
Yeah. I've played it once, but God forbid I actually remember the name that I've... Phasmophobia, there we go.
Ooh.
And it's really cool. It's like a indie game that's in some ways total garbage, but regardless... It's really like the whole thing is that you're trying to gather evidence, and based on the type of ghost, like you'll just discover certain things. So kind of just taking that concept as well, where if you have some variation in your ghosts, then you get to do a lot more with it. And yeah, it having the hunt be kind of the fun of it as well.
Yeah, totally. Totally. I would do an entire adventure where like 2/3 of it is trying to figure out the mystery behind the thing that the town has hired them to take care of. And then 1/3 of it is the big climactic fight against the thing. Mm-hmm. Usually involving some sort of some brazen morality mess or some sort of a philosophical pontification that the bad guy can yell at them while he's beating the crap out of them. That's always very fun for me.
That's great. All right, cool. So that's good to know. I'll have to check that out. I can honestly say I've never looked in the Pathfinder bestiary, but obviously there's good stuff in there. I mean,
yeah, very, very flavorful, very good stuff. A lot of fun stuff.
Sweet. Well, hey, thanks for coming on. This was, oh, do you have one other thing?
Nope.
Oh, you were pointing. Yeah,
I was pointing at you.
Like,
I was like, yes, yeah, you, man. You, man. Sorry.
You're fine. Benjamin, thank you so much for coming on and talking about curses with us. This was fantastic. It was really good.
Yeah, it's not a great insight.
Thank you for having me. I really like this show. I'm not a big 5th edition boy, but I listen to this show a lot. I think your fans are very smart and attractive, and they...
And then you don't know our fans.
I know that listening to your show automatically makes them good people. I really like the show. It is an absolute honor to have been invited on to do this. I really love talking to you guys any chance that I get. Feel free to call me anytime. If you're throwing one shots or whatever, hook me up. I will absolutely show up and give you all sorts of flubberty druthers. So
what was that?
Thank
word?
You very much, flubberty druthers. That's where you make a whole sentence out of one word, but the word doesn't make any sense.
All right.
You succeeded. Yeah.
So thank you very much, monsters and multiclass. Hope to see you around.
Yeah, and thank you.
Yeah, same to you.
That's great.
Yeah, see thanks, ya. Man.
So before we get into our monsters, let's go ahead and have our promotional minute. If you are not yet, make sure to subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a review when you can. Make sure to follow us on Twitter. That is @monsters_multi. Follow or subscribe to our subreddit, rmonstersandmulticlass. And if you want to help support the show, you can go to monstersandmulticlass.com/support. And without further ado, we're going to be talking about classical monsters, Halloween monsters, the type of stuff that you think of when you hear spooky, scary skeleton play.
Well,
skeletons. Yeah.
A lot more than just skeletons.
Skeletons, ghouls, ghosts, ghasts, maybe even scarecrows if we're feeling crazy.
Zombies.
Can't forget zombies.
Good old zombies. Basically, all of the stat blocks, they're a little small for their own episode, so big group of them up together. But
they're the type of monsters that I feel like get used out of, I mean, in every campaign. Yeah. I don't think I've ever had a campaign go through where I didn't have literally all of those. A skeleton, zombies, ghouls, ghosts. They just feel like such staples. It would be criminal for us to ignore them.
Mm-hmm.
And what better time to talk about them than the spookiest time of the year?
A few days before Halloween.
Yeah, but we're not going to like market this one too hard as a Halloween episode, because every time we try and do a holiday episode, people just stop listening.
It is true. Our holiday episodes are consistently the worst. Like, listen.
Your Santa build is so slept on. It's not even funny.
Now that it's become esoteric, you're like, yeah, okay, I'm in on the Santa build. Only 300 people listen to that one? Oh, yeah. All about Santa. Or all my plays. All mine.
All right, on to the topic at hand. Just a general point I want to make about all of these and why I think they are so common, even though they could almost be said that they're overdone. I mean, very much so. Is they're comfortable. There is so many weird and bizarre monsters and creatures out there in the D&D world to pull from the various books and homebrewing, where it's, I think players can get their fill of the unique, crazy, how exactly does this work? What could it do? Let us figure it out. You sometimes just need those encounters where everybody knows what to expect. They're zombies. They're hard to kill. They're undead. They're slow. They're dumb. Great. Here's a whole bunch of them. Figure it out. Same with ghosts. Oh, they can be incorporeal and move through things, and they can drain your strength, and they can possess people. Great. Figure it out. I think that really has a place, and the fact that these type of monsters that are really just overdone and kind of typical just keep showing up in campaigns over and over and over really says something about that.
No, you bring up a great point. It's like comfort food to some extent. Or instead of having to sit here,
eat mashed potatoes, others slay zombie skeletons.
Right, that's how metaphors work. You do one thing or the other. Yeah, I mean, it's still just like you have those fights where it's not about trying to figure a bunch of stuff out. It's just about killing ghouls. I like that. All right, so let's start with skeletons. Just not alphabetical, because we're going to be jumping all around. And I worry that if we start at the top of the alphabet, then you're going to want to stick to it, Kevin. So I'm just blowing that up right now. Skeletons first.
Sure. There's a bunch of them.
Are there? There are, actually. You're right. But for the most part, it seems to me like just a variation. Like, if you want something to be a skeleton, give it these couple of things. Because in the Monster Manual, we've got the skeleton, the Minotaur skeleton, the Warhorse skeleton. But then if you go outside of that, there's just like 50 different miscellaneous skeleton things.
I did not know this. It turns out most things have a skeleton.
Isn't there like a skeleton shark, though? Don't they have cartilage? Or do they also have bones?
I'm pretty sure they also have bones.
It's just their teeth. It's just their teeth, man.
Okay, all right.
Or they're lying to us about those sharks they found, and they were never big, and it's just to make kids excited. I don't know.
All right.
I'm not going to do that.
So all skeletons have a few things in common. That's they're usually vulnerable to bludgeoning damage. This is one of the few times that vulnerabilities come up. So for that, I really like it, because it's like one of the few times that somebody gets to go like, oh, they're actually vulnerable. This like is going to matter. Probably not so much with your regular 1/4 challenge rating skeletons and their 13 HP.
Ah,
but still,
at level one, it's like you get one attack, you roll 1d6 plus 2. It's like if it's vulnerable, that's the difference between one-shotting it or having to do multiple rounds.
Yeah, no, that's dope. And it's awesome because it's very accessible and you can dunk on people. I miss when they were resistant to piercing damage.
Yeah, I think that's a little weird that they're not. And I guess that's like an easy thing you can throw in as a DM if you want. Just, hey, they're also resistant to piercing, because where are you going to pierce?
Right. Yeah, and if you're kind of going on what's logical, I'd also put them resistant to slashing. It just makes it more interesting. They're resistant to piercing and slashing, vulnerable to bludgeoning.
Piercing makes more sense because if you think about like an arrow, like if I shoot you in the skeleton with an arrow, I'm probably going to miss. I'm going to hit the fleshy bits.
Right.
I hit you with a longsword, it's like, yeah, I'm going to hit the bones eventually.
That's perfectly fair. That's kind of how I've thought about it as well. Like, if I slash against bone, I'm going to at least hit the bone. Whereas if I try and pierce through you, there's a good chance you're going to just not actually get a solid hit in there.
Right.
But again, easy thing that you can do.
Plus it bullies rogues, which is great.
Using their rapier.
Rapiers, any kind of bow, just...
Right.
Hey, you suck today.
Sorry, man.
Your shit.
You're just not good with skeletons. Dunked on. One thing that I have seen before with skeletons is they're often made as minions, where like, you know, a single hit destroys them. One way that you can do that and retain the bludgeoning vulnerability is you make it so that they're one hit minions, just like literally any bludgeoning hit against a skeleton will destroy it, whereas any slashing, piercing, or any other types of damage, they take two hits to kill. So I love using minions whenever possible because it's just less to track as a DM. Much, much easier just to say like, all right, you know, I don't care that they have 13 health. The first hit you did 3, the second one you did 5, whatever. You hit it twice, it's dead. But it makes the person who's using bludgeoning, the one who's just going around, just smacking every skeleton, destroying them on every hit. When you've got waves and waves of them, it can feel pretty awesome.
Right. So when you say minions, do you mean they have their same actions and conditions and stuff like that, but basically they die in a hit?
Yep. You just don't track health.
Right.
Because it's not worthwhile. And once you get to mid high levels, doing 13 damage in one attack is barely anything, so just less bookkeeping.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that's important when you're running any kind of skeletal fight because you need a lot of them and you'd rather just not bother with it.
Right. And I think that goes for a lot of these types of monsters, skeletons, zombies, I'll even say some ghosts. They make sense to be in numbers, like just fighting one or two of them. Yes, it makes sense at lower levels, but there's no reason that a party of level 12 adventurers won't fight skeletons. And if you want to make them fight skeletons, you're going to need like 50. Or again, you want them to be a threat, but not an annoying bookkeeping moment when you're having them fight a necromancer.
Right. Yeah, they do it for all damage, but yeah, makes sense. But yeah, with skeletons, I feel like I can't say anything new about how would you use them. And like minions to powerful wizards and necromancers and liches or more powerful undead, or the land is cursed and the dead have risen from the graveyard and you have zombies and skeletons based on how recently they were dead or what have you. You're doing a demon campaign and you're fighting them up against Orcus, the demon lord of undeath, and he has a million skeletons.
A million, Kevin? They're never going to get through that.
You're trying to kill Orcus, the demon lord of the undeath. I mean...
What if you are a drunken monk?
Ooh. That'd be I would love that. I'd love
That'd
that.
Be perfect just... for killing 1 million skeletons.
Yeah. Takes like, what, 3 turns?
Yeah, pretty sure they can do a million hits in 3 turns.
Yeah. No, you're still better off with 1 fireball, actually. There's the sad, sad truth of it.
Yeah.
But what you can do to vary up your skeletons is exactly what the Monster Manual does. A skeleton can be just about anything. It doesn't have to just be a humanoid skeleton. And even if it is, you can make it a... Like, what it died with can be different. It can be a skeleton with a wand of fireballs, if you want it to.
Mm-hmm.
It can be a skeleton with... Just a dumb thing to add, but it can have a shield. raising its armor class. It can have different weapons. You can have a skeleton with a great sword instead of a short sword. They're very blank. They're blank slates, so that you can change them around as much as you want. You can make one a bard, and it plays its ribs. Cast spells.
Perfect. That's incredible. Uh-huh. It's perfect.
Yeah. I'm glad that's it. That's, yeah. We're just done. We're done. Just yeah, that's incredible.
Those are the three things you did.
Just to wrap up, just for the sake of the template, the base skeleton has vulnerability to bludgeon, immunity to poison, conditioned immunities of exhaustion and poisoned, dark vision out to 60 feet, it understands all languages and new in life, but can't speak. And then it has actions. The pre-written one is as a short sword, where it's 1d6 plus 2 piercing damage, or a short bow of same damage. But of course, that's where you could very easily switch it out.
Right. Like, maybe instead of a short sword, it has a short bone, and it just, like, uses a bone and smacks people, and it's just a club.
Why would they carry a weapon they're vulnerable to?
Because that's the sad skeleton who doesn't like any of his friends.
That's the traitor skeleton.
Yeah. I like how you make it sound like, oh, why would he carry the weapon that he's vulnerable to, as if like people are going to take the bone off of him and start hitting him with it.
Actually, no, that was my only weakness besides being generally weak.
Right. I mean, and also
that sounds awesome though.
And also, I know this isn't like so much mechanically written into the game, but you know, humanoids like people and elves and orcs and gnomes and halflings are also generally kind of vulnerable to being slashed in the gut or pierced through the neck with the swords they carry.
Lowercase vulnerable. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, so.
But I do like the idea of like one of like the fighter doesn't have a bludgeoning weapon, and so he just is like, can I just take one of the bones from the skeletons that I killed and use it as a club? Yes.
Yes. You 100,000% can do that. Yep.
Yeah. Alright, cool. We're not gonna talk about like Minotaur skeletons, Warhorse, and the other 700, right?
Not in detail. They all are just like little variations.
Which ones do you like? Which one do you
like? All right. The skeletal juggernaut. And this is a skeleton made out of regular skeletons.
So where do you see the description for that?
It's in Ghosts of Saltmarsh, I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, no.
As but, seen lumbering across the beaches in Isle of the Abbey, a skeletal juggernaut is an oversized bipedal assembly of bones that loses a portion of its mass with each step. These skeletal guardians hold together for only a short time before disassembling into a gang of individual undead.
I have no description. Like, I have the stat block, and that's it. I don't find a description. But that's fine. That sounds neat.
Yeah.
Yeah, so what?
That's super neat.
Yeah. So, yeah, challenge rating 5, so we actually are getting up there. But 142 hit points, which for challenge rating 5 feels high.
Except for the fact that it loses 10 HP at the start of its turn.
That's why it has so much. Yeah. same vulnerabilities and immunities and all that. Disassemble. If the juggernaut is reduced to 0 hit points, 12 skeletons rise from its remains. And it's falling apart. If the juggernaut does not have all of its hit points at the start of its turn, it loses 10. Makes 2 claw attacks, which are plus 6 to hit, 10-foot reach. This thing's large. 2d8 plus 3 Sleercing, or it has Avalanche of Bones. Recharge of 5.
Did you say Sleercing?
I think I did.
He said Sleercing. It's slashing.
It was kind of like a mental comment. I almost said piercing and then corrected it. Slashing, right. And Sleercing came out, and I just moved on, hoping no one would find out, but thank you for pointing it.
Okay, well, Kevin, just because you think nobody noticed doesn't mean that I don't get a bunch of hate mail in our P.O. box from people saying
P.O. box.
Yeah, I opened up a P.O. box.
On Twitter.
Did he say Sleercing?
Anyways, yeah, so it does some sleeshing damage. And the Avalanche of Bones, what's that do?
Well, it's a recharge of 5 or 6, and the juggernaut collapses into a large heap before quickly reforming. Each creature within 10 feet of the juggernaut must make a DC 14 dex save, or taking 4d8 bludgeoning damage on a fail, have as much on a success. If a creature that fails the saving throw, it is also knocked prone.
It's almost like an avalanche of bones or something.
Right? Yeah, it just collapses.
That is some awesome flavor. I actually wish
Great, right?
I wish I saw this earlier, because I did a one shot and did like a ghost tower, and it's just like a whole bunch of ghosts, but I totally could have used this instead, and I think it would have worked a little bit better, actually.
Ghost just Tower. All right, we'll talk about that when we get to ghosts.
Okay. Shit, I got to bring up the stat block. No, this is great though. It's like the Power Ranger combination of skeletons.
Yeah, and the nice thing is it ends with more skeletons. So right. You're like, oh, I want them to fight skeletons, but a little bit different. You get everything here. This is having your cake and eating your skeletons too.
And just the absolutely amazing visual of all of it. I mean, first just seeing a 12-foot tall skeleton that's made up of other skeletons, it collapsing with bones and like trying to sweep you off your feet. And then reassembling, also a great visual. But then at the end of it, when the party's like, oh, sweet, we did it. Just all the bones shaking and coming back together as 12 more skeletons. Just that moment from the players of like, ugh, like here we go again. Love it. Mm-hmm. Love that.
Yeah. And then in terms of the other ones, I mean, you just have stuff like the skeleton minotaur, and which has the charge ability and could still have a torrent so it could gore. It's just like, it's basically taken a couple of the aspects that apply to these creatures in non-skeletal form and applying them to the base skeleton stat block.
Right, like the skeletal alchemist. It's like, this could just be an alchemist, but it's vulnerable to bludgeoning, immune to poison, and that's about it.
Yeah, you should be able to figure out the pattern pretty damn quick. So the giant skeleton, guess what? It's just a giant skeleton.
But yeah, so there's a ton you could do there if you want to use skeletons and your party, especially if your party's getting higher level, just make new skeletons. Throw a bunch at them. A lot you could do.
Or just throw multiple skeletal juggernauts at them. So that they're fighting 24 skeletons at once.
Or that's the type of thing I would expect where, if it's like a war campaign or it's leading up to a massive battle and it's like the Sword Coast is going to war with Thay. The liches of Thay would be having these skeletal juggernauts just swarming the battlefield.
Yes. That's also a great visual. Just 50 of them. Also, they've got bone crossbows. Crossbones.
Oh. They've got crossbows made out of skeletons that shoot skeletons. The skeleton being shot can then shoot you with its short bow while it's just about to hit you.
Well, there's an ogre that has like a goblin launcher, and I basically want that to some skeletons. Yeah, just like launching them off their
back.
They can't
walk very far because they suck, so you like launch these skeletal juggernauts at people.
Just threw a bag of bones and it reformed into a giant skeleton. Sweet. All right, let's move on before the word skeleton loses meaning. You want to do ghosts?
Sure. I like ghosts. Ghost inspectors. There is just the ghost stat block. It's challenge rating 4, but it does just make for a really interesting fight. Possibly very tough, depending on your party's composition and what they have. 45 hit points, damage resistances to almost everything, acid, fire, lightning, thunder, and then bludgeoning, piercing, and slashing from non-magical attacks, and immunities to cold, necrotic, and poison. Condition immunities of charms, exhausted, frightened, grappled, paralyzed, petrified, poisoned, prone, and restrained. So it's really hard to just like shut these things down. Pretty much you need a magic weapon to attack them. I guess it kind of sucks to be like a wizard or a sorcerer in fighting a ghost.
Yeah, I guess so. You still can do force damage?
Yeah.
Occasionally?
And psychic?
Yeah.
Warlocks are never shut
down. I was going to say, just Eldritch Blast them.
And I think this is one that is a little bit weird in its challenge rating 4 slot. Because against a lower level party, specifically saying like a level 4 or 5 party, one or two of these could very quickly destroy the party. Between its possession ability, which just lets it do that, one humanoid that ghost can see within 5 feet must succeed a DC 13 saving throw or become possessed. The target becomes incapacitated, the ghost controls their body, and can't be targeted by like any spell except for Dispel Evil and Good,
or which Turn
isn't
Undead.
Like a common one, or a Turn Undead, right, which is a little more common. Mm-hmm. If you have a cleric or a paladin, then you've got that. But taking over just somebody can really swing the fight, because now the party is attacking their friend, so they're expending resources to expend resources. And that can get really dangerous really quickly.
Right, and it's like you attack your friend and drop your friend to zero hit points, and the ghost pops out unharmed. It's not like it's taking damage as you do this, and then
right,
you just keep bouncing around. Luckily, the save's low of 13, but it definitely happens. We've definitely played where ghosts have possessed our party members.
And it makes for a really interesting fight, that's for sure. It's the type of one that I feel like you have to be somewhat careful, I guess. It just feels like it can be very swingy, and you might not be totally prepared for it. It's on paper a fight that is either going to be really easy, as they just cut through it in like two turns. It only has an AC of 11. Everybody succeeds their charisma saving throw when it comes up, and then boom, it's over. Or somebody's going to get possessed, and it's going to be a huge resource drain. So
that's just why I think it's horrible to do. Like, if you're like, oh, I'll just add two ghosts, don't. Like, just don't do that. Because that could be a fight ender right there. You know, oh, double possession. What you gonna do? It's like now half the party is against the other half of the party, and the ghosts haven't been hit.
Yeah, the only time that you can is when you start having a cleric. And they don't possess the cleric. And then
that's another thing. You know, if you also have to look at the health with anything with huge resistances like this, does this thing have 45 health? That depends on your party. If you have a warlock and a cleric, yes, it has 45 health. This is going to be easy. If you have none of those things, it now has 90 health.
Right. Yep. And do they have magical weapons? If you don't have magical weapons, then your fighter might be totally worthless.
Yeah, well, it's resistant, not immune.
This was lucky. Resistance sucks, but it's...
You're right. Immunity
is just ender.
You are correct. This one,
it's... Yeah. Now it's 90 health. That's a huge difference.
Right. So the Ghost also has Withering Touch. This is its basic melee attack, where it's 4d6 plus 3 necrotic damage, which is kind of a lot. Etherealness, where it could pop back and forth between the ethereal plane. And then Horrifying Visage, where it's basically a scare. DC 13 wisdom save anything within 60 feet, or it's frightened for 1 minute. And then it has a rider where if they fail by 5 or more of that DC 13 wisdom save, that they age 1d4 times 10 years.
I was playing a one shot and I had multiple ghosts in it. This is the one that I used the ghost tower in. And I kept succeeding on the Horrifying Visage, but it was on the elf. The one who was just like, I don't care. They're like, yeah, I'm like a 200-year-old elf. Oh, now I'm 220? That changed nothing. You did absolutely nothing.
Right.
It was so frustrating. I wanted it to land on somebody that like actually would have mattered, but nope.
Yeah. But so that's interesting. I haven't really seen that. Again, we've definitely fought ghosts in various campaigns, and I haven't seen that really come up. The aging. I guess it's kind of hard to fail a wisdom save of DC 13 by more than 5. You know, it just... Already at the low, very low. Roll very low.
What's that, like 1 in 4 if you have no proficiency there? Give or take.
Well, yeah.
And that's kind of a big deal. The aging thing is like they more or less kind of shunted that out of the game. But we still see like certain classes are immune to stuff like that. Certain other things like you just can't, you can reverse it, you can ignore it. But it's kind of hard to get across. I think it's better flavor text. It's like...
Yeah, we talked
this
a lot about it.
Ran into the ghost, and they're now an old person.
Right. We talked about it a lot with the Sphinx as well, where to some extent it's just kind of not that fun, and there's like no mechanics around aging, so maybe you're just ruining a player's idea of their character.
Right. Eh?
That's not like that fun if it's like, oh, I want to play a plucky 16-year-old. Oh, just kidding, you're 56 now.
Now you're a plucky 56-year-old.
And maybe some people are like super into that and they're like, oh, it's cool. I'm like a young person trapped in an old person's body. All right. You know, there's something to that. That can be kind of cool. But again, you got to be careful with
it. Yeah, if the player's not into that just complete upheaval of their character concept, especially if this happens early on in a campaign before they got to like really feel like they've played and kind of quote unquote got to know their character. And then this happens, it's like, well, this is like the second session. I would have made a 60-year-old if I wanted somebody who was older. I didn't make a 60-year-old person.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, yeah. And I'm not even saying that it's like, it's bad. Because I could see somebody like really enjoying that and thinking that that's really fun.
Mm-hmm.
especially as you said, if you're like, oh, I don't really know who my character is, they kind of just come into this adventuring life and then out of nowhere they're shot forward 30 years and they're an old person with a young person's mind. Now they're like, oh, this is my character and this is really cool. Great. That's fine. You know, as long as you're into it, that's okay.
Right.
But I would totally have a meta conversation with them where it says like, the effects can be reversed with a greater restoration spell, but only within 24 hours of it occurring. If they were like, hey, this sucks, just be like, be cool. Be cool, DM. All right? Be like, oh, yeah, okay, it actually reverses in 24 hours.
Right.
Shrug. I mean, whatever.
Or they run into a kind-hearted cleric who travels the land to help out people in the name of their god, and here's a greater restoration.
Right. Like, oh, hey, I was actually making my way here to deal with those ghosts myself and not have to involve any of you. Well, I guess I'll just greater restore you real quick as a thank you.
Yep. In terms of when to use ghosts, just like skeletons, you know when to use ghosts. It's haunted houses and, again, cursed lands. And somebody dies violently with unfinished business and their spirit sticks around and you're asked as the adventuring party, hey, I'll pay you some money if you can take care of this or give you a reward or just please be kind and help me. That sort of stuff.
Do you ever watch like a tutorial video because you're like stuck on something, just whatever it is, video game, home improvement, a hobby, just something that you just cannot figure out. So you like go out of your way to look up some tutorial videos. And as you're watching it, it gets to the part where you need help and they just skip over it because they're like, that's not going to be a problem. I just imagine somebody came here out of like, doesn't know our show at all. And they're just like, yeah, I want to hear about ghosts. Let's hear about it. And it gets to like, yeah, you know how to use ghosts. And they're like,
you
no!
do know how to use ghosts. If you don't know how to use ghosts, you need to be like starting with a more general podcast about, I don't know, life in the current year. Is a thing haunted? Yes or no? That means it has a ghost or not.
My point is, you never know what part somebody came here for.
I went through it anyways.
I know. It's happened to me way too many times. I've been burned a lot.
In terms of a unique, more not so tropey way of using them, I could see them being thrown over as minions of a certain kind. If a necromancer or a lich or whatever has a particular artifact that can control ghosts or create ghosts or whatever, so they're not always just like this lone thing haunting an area. And that way you can kind of get some really interesting fights where it's you kind of have all these undead minions and a ghost there too.
Right. Yeah, and I think that it can really be a difficult and interesting minion for a bigger fight. The only thing that you have to worry about is just, again, completely taking somebody out of it, because the only way to get the person or the ghost out of the body, if you don't have any of these spells and such, is by dropping your friend to 0 HP. And then bringing them back up if they want to be in the fight. So that can really suck, potentially, if it's like, oh, this is a big, interesting fight, and you're out of it round one, and you're actually just attacking your friends now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, hand in your character sheet. You're about to just sit here and be bored.
Right.
But that's just from a meta perspective. From a, like, entirely good gameplay, interesting fight, yes, it works very well as a minion.
Right. Yeah, or you could easily cap that instead of making a recharge 6 doing it. It's a 1 per short rest ability, which thinking of a ghost resting is a little weird, but just to put a limit on it, kind of once per encounter. And maybe it's only, I guess, a minute in D&D combat's really long. That's still 10 rounds. Maybe they get to reroll their save at the end of each round or something like that.
Reroll their save, roll a d6, and that's how many rounds it's for that they're possessed for.
Right.
There's tons of things you can do to just put a limit on it. And I think that's a very good way to handle it, is use a ghost, but put a limit on that for more important fights or where the ghost isn't like the bad guy.
Right. Or it's a higher level campaign and, you know, the players have plenty of spells to take care of the possession and you just leave it as is and let them burn the resource.
It's their problem.
Yep.
Yeah. So I mentioned that I did a ghost tower and I really didn't change like a ton stat wise. I made a ghost with a ton more health, and just the idea was it was a bunch of ghosts who have gathered together and gotten really large. And I'm pretty sure I stole the idea from Paper Mario and the Thousand Year Door. It's like, game does not deserve to be as good as it is, but it's amazing. and just added in some like legendary actions with etherealness. I made that a legendary action because I feel like actions like etherealness never actually get used in gameplay. Because it's like, oh yeah, as an entire action, they can go to the ethereal plane and to the material plane and vice versa. So making that a legendary action made them able to just like disappear out as long as they had the resources for it. Making additional attacks as a legendary action, and then a spirit drop, which was basically just slopping off some spirits to then possess skeletons or zombies nearby the ghost tower.
Nice.
That was cool.
Yeah.
I guess I'm just a really big fan of huge undead things. You know how they're small and like, you know, there's like a lot that are really wide? What if we just made them really tall instead? And I'm there.
Perfect. Cool. All right. Zombies.
What sure. about specters, Kevin?
I did say specter, didn't I? They're like an offshoot of ghosts.
They're ghosts without the annoying parts.
You're right. They're weaker, right? Yeah, so Spectre, they're just challenge rating 1, but they hit really hard.
Yeah, they have
a challenge rating 1.
Plus 4 to hit life drain that does 3d6 necrotic damage, and then a DC 10 con save, and if the target fails, their maximum HP is reduced by the same amount.
So definitely one of those monsters that you could just kill a level 1 party really easily, and not like hurt them badly and knock them out, just kill in one attack.
Yeah, with 3d6, yes.
Yeah.
Especially if you like a wizard who has a, you know, they didn't put any points in con, they have 6 hit points. If they have to put their con up to 14, they have 8 hit points at level 1. I mean, there's just...
I'd say even just level 1 and level 2 both are extremely dangerous here because, I mean, say DC 10 con saving throw, we're talking about for most characters at low level, a 40% chance that they're going to fail that, depending on if they're proficient in saving throws for con and whatever else. But still, that's enough so that I would be at least nervous about throwing this at a low-level party, unless, again, they're expecting it to some extent.
Right. Yeah, lore-wise, the difference between a specter and a ghost has their kind of unfinished business, and they're still very much a strong connection to who they were, and that kind of personality feeds in, and when their unfinished business does resolve, they usually leave. A specter's been divorced from all that. They're just an angry spirit stuck roaming the land, attacking anything they see. There's really nothing that just makes them pass on.
Yep, they're just evil.
Yeah. Yeah, not a whole lot of interesting things there, to be honest.
You can't do a friendly specter. You can do a friendly ghost.
Mm-hmm. Like Gaspar.
He was actually a huge dick. I got nothing. I'm not going to go on a tangent with that.
Universally loved.
I almost rewatched that movie recently, so I can't say anything about it.
Just, yeah, we'll do an episode on Casper the Friendly Ghost as a D&D enemy next week.
Well, how could you? How could you have a ghost as a friendly party member? If they
never let anybody come to your table and be like, I'm going to be a ghost.
I don't think as a player character. But if they met an NPC and then realized that, like, oh, this isn't a specter, like we were told, it actually is like a ghost that just has unfinished business, I could see the party being like, well, maybe we should try and help this thing move on instead of just attacking it. And that could be fun.
What a novel concept. It's like, oh, yeah, I want to move on, but I just have this one small quest. And I'm like, fuck that. We're already on a quest to beat you today.
Oh, I hate when quests become more quests. Let's just kill them and get it over with. That's always funny, because like, as a DM, if you present that, you still just got to roll with it. It's like, all right, well, you guys just wanted to kill it. I can't take away your autonomy, so.
All right, moving on to zombies.
Zombies, yeah.
So zombies are pretty much just piss poor boring, except for exactly one thing. So their challenge rating 1/4, armor class of 8, 22 hit points, speed of 20. All of their stats, except for strength, are negative when they have +1 strength. Immune to poison. They have a single slam attack, +3 to hit, 1d6 +1 bludgeoning damage. The only thing that really makes them interesting is the undead fortitude. If damage reduces the zombie to 0 hit points, it makes a con save with a DC of 5 plus the damage taken. And I'm sorry, it is +3 to con. I was wrong on my stats there. So it's a con save of +3. 5 plus the damage taken, unless the damage is radiant from a critical hit. On a success, the zombie drops to 1 hit point instead. So they just keep coming. They're hard
to kill. Which I think is actually a cool mechanical way to do the, you have to chop their head off.
Right.
Without being annoying about it.
Right.
Yeah, since you can't call shots, this is basically how that's done. If they fail their con save, then it's, you manage to chop their head off. If not, you didn't.
Right. And I could see from a mechanical standpoint, if the party figures this out and has a lot of zombies to kill, trying to crit fish a little bit more, you know, tripping them so that they can like get them on the ground and try and smash the head, just any way that they can give themselves advantage on the attack so that they've got a better chance of critting and just being done with the thing. Of course, yeah, they're still going to get some hits that just kill them regardless, but it changes up the playstyle a bit if you want it to.
Mm-hmm.
My only big issue is that their speed is just too high. 20 feet is too much.
I don't know, yeah, actually, but it's just one of those things. Yeah, it kind of is. If you have, like, you look at him, he's not got the fast zombie stance.
No.
He's got the slow zombie stance. But at the same time, this is not a zombie horror survival game. You don't have, like, 4 bullets. You have, you know, trained warriors with unlimited uses of a weapon. So it kind of, I don't know. I think it's just more settling for the mechanical realities of D&D.
Right.
Oh, and I hate when that happens.
Speaking of settling for the mechanical realities of D&D, zombies do miss a really crucial thing that is pretty much present with zombies. Like, almost everything that includes them is that zombies can turn other creatures into zombies, usually by biting them, and oftentimes by scratching them as well. And there's absolutely nothing for that in 5th edition. Which
is because they're absolutely not that kind of zombie,
right?
You know, they are a body that a necromancer brought back for sick reasons,
right?
You're right. I could see making that a variant, though, a zombie that is a like infectious zombie, and it just has an ability that if you reduce to 0 or whatever, when you're bitten, you make a con saving throw. If you fail and you're reduced to 0, you come back as a zombie, reduce your max HP by something or another every day,
right?
Which is, that's actually a phenomenal idea for a campaign, is just adding a rider on these zombies and like setting them, like in your head, setting them upon the world. And now you've got a huge fucking problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. Depending on how many people with, you know, lesser restoration, you know.
Yeah. I mean, this is, for the party, it's like whatever. For
right.
For the village that the party just entered, huge problem. Fucking problem.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. Totally
like apocalyptic
fair.
Level problem. I'm 100% in favor of zombie Sword Coast.
I can't do it. I had a really bad recurring nightmare when I was a kid with zombies. So I'm not going to be the one to run that. It'll mess me up too much. Sure, I've gotten over it, but I'm sure it'll come back.
Is this true?
I did actually have a really bad recurring nightmare as a kid about zombies.
Interesting. I won't ask you to talk about it. That's all right, but it's interesting.
There's not much to talk about. It's not interesting. Talking about your dreams is never interesting. Like I didn't roller skate in real life, but I was roller skating, and a kid in my class in elementary school went past me. I want you to cut this because it's going to be so boring. Talking about dreams is never interesting. Either way, he roller skated past me and he's like, hey, you got to get home. You know, the sun's going down and they're coming out. And I'm like, what do you mean they're coming out? And as I get like to my house, I look down the street and I see a horde of zombies coming towards me. And then it's basically all just me in my house. They're trying to attack and get in. And the dreams finally stopped when it progressed to the point that I like was hiding behind one of those kids' art easels. And as I moved it to the side and like saw behind, it was just my gym teacher. And then I was like, these aren't zombies at all. That's just my gym teacher. And I never had the dream again.
Weird.
Yeah. I mean, it's all because I played this Super Nintendo game called My Neighbors Are Zombies or something like that.
Oh,
Zombies Ate My Neighbors?
Is that probably what it is? It's something like that. I don't remember.
That's a classic.
So, yeah. Anyways, zombie campaign. Yeah. Sounds cool.
Yeah. You know, so yeah, D&D, the Azran zombies, anywhere you would use a skeleton, you could also use a zombie. It's just a less decomposed version of a skeleton. They have their trade-offs in what they can do.
Yeah, but skeletons could hold weapons.
Yeah.
But is there any reason that really you couldn't easy. Give zombies, just give zombies swords?
I would say they wouldn't have the dexterity to do it. And I don't mean in the mechanical sense, because obviously they have like the strength to attack with a weapon. But I just like, I think they would lack the ability to hold a weapon and swing it effectively.
That's fair. And I was going to say, what about a club? But they already have the slam attack, and that would be the exact same
thing. Yeah, 1d6 plus 1. Yep. You have a bunch of different variations of zombies, the exact same skeletons. You could have zombie ogres and zombie orcs or whatever. Basically kind of the same idea as skeletons.
Zombie T-Rex, though.
I saw that.
And Tomb of Annihilation.
Zombie Beholder, too.
Yeah, we talked about that during the Beholder episode, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's less of a zombie and more of a beholder. I don't know.
Oh, I looked at the Tyrannosaurus zombie, and the only thing that's specifically interesting about it is this disgorge zombie. As a bonus action, the Tyrannosaurus zombie can disgorge a normal zombie, which appears in an unoccupied space within 10 feet of it. And then it just
It's like a zombie APC. Like it stomps into combat carrying all these zombies.
And
it's
just
awesome.
Vomits them onto the field. So that's actually pretty awesome.
Yeah. Oh, and if it's still has this trait when it dies, 1d4 normal zombies erupt from its corpse at the start of the next turn.
Nice.
Yeah. Crazy. All right. Not much more to say on zombies. Move to the final set, ghouls. Ghouls and ghasts.
They're like zombies, but in better shape.
Yeah, kind of, yeah. You get your...
Yeah, what are these things? No, I'm just looking at them. I'm trying to figure out, like, what is a ghoul and what makes them differ? They're undead. They're not...
They're from, like, hell. That's the difference. Right. They're, like, a demon-created... Zombies, because they were like, these zombies are really bad.
Right. Looked at the normal zombie stat block, and it's like, nah, that's not really what I'm trying to accomplish.
No, 20-foot movement speed? I don't think so.
Yeah.
Let's AC see if we can eight? Trick some elves.
Yeah, ghouls trace the origin to the Abyss. Dorsin, the first of the kind, was an elf worshiper of Orcus. Of course, it's Orcish. Orcus. Any undead traces back to Orcus. Turned against his own people, he feasted on humanoid flesh to honor the demon prince of undeath. As a reward for his service, Orcus transformed Dorius into the first ghoul. Served Orcus faithfully in the Abyss, greeting ghouls from the demon lord's other servants. Yeah. So that's the difference. Zombies are a raised, shambling, rotting corpse. A ghoul is it's similar to a zombie, but it's just its own monstrous entity.
Yeah. It's got some lore to it. Right.
Right.
That I feel like is going to be forgotten every time it's used.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. It's because it doesn't matter. They're just
right.
They're scary things. They're going to try and eat you. Roll initiative.
Yeah. So a ghoul is a challenge rating 1, armor class at 12, 22 hit points, immune to poison, charm, exhausted, poison damage, and the poison condition. It has 2 options to attack. It only gets 1 bite. 2d6 plus 2 piercing damage plus 2 to hit, or its claws, which is almost a little interesting, plus 4 to hit, 2d4 plus 2 slashing damage. If you hit, it's a DC 10 con save or it's paralyzed for a minute. Target repeat the save. The reason I say it's almost interesting is DC 10 is so incredibly low, it's almost never worth giving up on that damage. Our current campaign, side shoot campaign, I'm playing a Hexblade who, for their Mystic Arcanum, to create undead, and so they get 3 ghouls when they cast it. So I've been using these things a lot, and I quickly gave up on trying to paralyze anything because DC 10 con save is passed so easily. Nothing and nobody dumps con.
To be fair, right now you are fighting things that, like, not just... They don't just have good con, they have, like, fantastic con most of the time.
Right.
I would say from a DM perspective, I could see just using the claws because the difference in 2 damage isn't as important as the potential for the paralysis and also just the scare factor, because there is something to be said about just making people roll after they get hit it is spooky.
Right.
It That's makes true. Them yeah. now afraid to get hit. So maybe one gets off, and if it does, great. But even if it doesn't, it makes it more interesting than just bite, you take damage, bite, you take damage. It's like, oh, hey, I got hit by the claws. Oh, no. Maybe this time something bad's going to happen. Also important to note, the claws are +4 to hit. The bite is +2.
Oh, I missed that. Shit. I also, for some reason, didn't click the only, it's only 2 average damage difference. For some reason, in my head, it was more. Well, I'm glad we talked about this. Yeah, all right. He's going to start using claws more. So have fun with that, Jared.
It's not going to happen much. Again, yeah. They all have like +6 to con.
Yeah.
It's just more rolling, man. Yeah. You just slow down combat. Thanks, Kevin. So then their counterpart, their stronger ones, is the Ghasts. So they are challenge rating 2, AC of 13, HP of 36, a little bit better stats all around. They have the same bite, that is +3 to hit, 2d8 +3 piercing damage. The claws, stronger as well, +5 to hit, 2d6 +3, and the exact same paralysis condition, DC 10 con saving throw. Their difference is that they have the stench ability, or I guess, what is that? Just effect?
Feature.
Any creature? Feature? Yeah, there you go. Any creature that starts its turn within 5 feet of the ghast must succeed on a DC 10 con saving throw or be poisoned until the start of its next turn. On a successful saving throw, the creature is immune to the ghast stench for 24 hours. And that is always where it gets killed for me. You have this crazy easy con saving throw, and then once they succeed once, it's like, yeah, okay. We tried.
Right, and it's not like being poisoned is terrible. It's not like it's an AoE paralyzed.
Right. It gives disadvantage on attack rolls and ability checks, but that's just interesting. So I'm pretty sure I've used this before where I took away that immunity for 24 hours thing. It's just like, if you are up close to it, you just have to keep dealing with that.
Right. Yeah, especially because it's only one turn.
Oh, yeah, that's even worse. Oh, my God. Why is it? Who put this immunity in? That's so stupid.
Yeah.
Yeah, whatever. Then it has Turning Defiance. The ghast and any ghouls within 30 feet of it have advantage on saving throws against effects that turn undead. So this is really nice in that if you do have a cleric with Turn Undead and you're worried about it just destroying this fight immediately, you have one ghast and a couple of ghouls, and there's a good chance that a couple of them will succeed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the lore of these is that it's quite literally Orcus gave them some more power than ghouls. And so they became ghasts.
Totally.
That is about
Orcus.
It.
Orcus sometimes infuses a ghoul with stronger dose of abyssal energy, making a ghast. Yep. What's interesting, though, is it does say a ghast is cunning and can inspire a pack of ghouls to follow its... Oh, I misread that. I'm sorry. I thought it said gnolls instead of ghouls.
Oh.
And I was like, where does that come in? No.
It doesn't.
It doesn't.
No, I can see gnolls and ghasts getting along. They both just kind of like to devour and eat and kill.
Sure.
I can see that actually just because they don't get along with anything that wouldn't make them friends.
Though then they're... Actually, no, they're probably mortal enemies.
They try to eat each other.
Yeah, they're probably mortal enemies because gnolls are from the demon lord Yinogu, ghouls and ghasts are from the demon lord Orcus, and all the demon lords absolutely hate each other. And actually, I think within the ghoul lore, it talks about an incursion from Yinogu. Yeah, robbed Dorisane of his abyssal domain, where Orcus would not be... Yeah, they're probably mortal enemies, never mind.
All that said, I still feel like if they saw each other, they'd just be more mad that, like, hey, those gnolls are eating those people that we wanted to eat.
Right.
More than, like, anything else. It wouldn't be like,
let's
gnolls.
Eat the gnolls.
Right. Like, no, I don't care about the gnolls. It's just, let me eat. Come on.
Yeah, so since they have these kind of abyssal origins, well, I don't know, I was going to say that makes them hard to kind of justify throwing them out there lore-wise, but gnolls are all over the place, so I don't know why Orcus wouldn't just put his ghouls on the material plane.
It's also...
Yeah, that's what you'll find in most campaigns, that ghouls is just... These ghouls just wander around. Nobody knows why they're here.
Right.
Just I'll also say it's easily ignorable lore.
Right.
Just, if you don't care, then just don't care. Why are they ghouls and ghasts instead of ghosts or specters? Because I wanted it to be.
Right.
And if the party's like, oh, actually, there's a lot of lore around orc, it's like, okay, well, not these ones. These ones
don't
are...
care. Roll initiative.
I love having lore behind fights and purposes for them, but if your purpose is to have an undead creature around this stat block doing this thing, it's okay. I don't know. I don't think this one needs much more to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know how to use ghouls. You just know. All right, I had one more monster I wanted to talk about that I always think makes me think of Halloween, and that is scarecrows. And I don't think we've done an episode on them. I can't remember.
No.
Okay, some reason I thought we did. Them. No, they're super basic. I do like them, though, because I think they are really fun to throw at a new party, like new D&D players, because, you know, throwing a skeleton, throwing a zombie, that is like an obvious, I understand the lore of this, but seeing a scarecrow actually start moving, it's one of those things that just, I think, sits with new players, because it's like, oh, I can't trust what I think I know about this world or about anything without confusing them by, you know, throwing like a beholder, and they're like, I can't even imagine that. It's a scarecrow. Everyone knows what a scarecrow looks like.
Right. Super creepy.
Yeah. So I don't even know. There's some lore to them that I didn't read. They're spirit powered.
It's animated by the bound spirit of a slain evil creature. Granted, it's purpose and mobility.
So a ghost just possesses a scarecrow.
Basically.
Yeah. And that's okay.
Or they're made by hags and witches, which we went over in some episode.
Yes.
They're a great thing to hide around your hag's coven, you know?
Yeah, definitely. So armor class 11, HP 36, speed of 30. Really just average stats across the board. Strength of 11, dex 13, con 11, 10 int, 10 wiz, and 13 charisma. Because they're just so suave and debonair. And they do have a damage vulnerability to fire, which is also nice. Again, I love vulnerabilities when they come up. Then a resistance to bludgeoning, piercing, and slashing from non-magical attacks, and an immunity to poison because they don't have a body. A lot of condition immunities. I think these all kind of fall in line with that. Like, when you don't have a body, you're kind of just immune to a lot of things. Mm-hmm.
Just the construct nature.
Right, so...
It's not the official one, but yeah.
Oh, yeah, it is a construct officially. So, charmed, exhaustion, frightened, paralyzed, poisoned, and unconscious. So, what happens when it hits zero if it can't be unconscious?
It becomes a regular scarecrow.
Yeah, it just dies.
All right, that's fine. Great, okay.
You can't non-lethally damage the scarecrow.
That makes sense, yeah. So it has false appearance. While the scarecrow remains motionless, it is indistinguishable from an ordinary inanimate scarecrow, which, of course, is just great mood setting as the party's walking through a field and they spot a scarecrow and they spot another one and a third one. And they're kind of just like, oh, why is the DM bringing up all of these scarecrows? And then 5 minutes later, they turn around and those three scarecrows are still behind them. Little things like that can just be extra spooky. I always love. For actions, it makes two claw attacks, and that is plus 3 to hit, 2d4 plus 1 slashing damage, and if the target is a creature, has to make a DC 11 wisdom saving throw or be frightened until the end of the scarecrow's next turn. And this is just like the basic frightened, where they have disadvantage on ability checks and can't move any closer. Yeah. Ability checks and attack rolls, not the one where they have to run away.
Right.
And then it has a terrifying glare, where can target one creature within 30 feet, DC 11 wisdom saving throw, magically frightened until the end of the next turn, and they're paralyzed. So that's great in groups, when one of them frightens somebody and paralyzes them, and they just swarm in and attack.
Yep.
Also make great minions because of that, though the DC's pretty low.
Yeah. At least if you pass, you're not immune for 24 hours.
Yes. Yeah, so it totally becomes justifiable that one of them just sits there and keeps doing the terrifying glare, or all of them do until one of them hits, and the second that it succeeds, you just see them switch gears and just close in and attack.
Yeah, another good classic scary monster. really set the mood.
The fire vulnerability, I think, is a big deal if you want to toss extras at people. Like, if your party has somebody with burning hands, this is a great opportunity to double the number of scarecrows, for instance.
It's true.
Yeah, and any...
Gotta keep that in mind.
Yeah, in the same sense of how you would use ghouls and ghasts, they're just kind of around. Say it's the same for scarecrow.
With the understanding that they would be places scarecrows are.
Right.
Yeah. It's true.
Yeah, like enter.
Yeah, if you're like 30 miles beneath the earth in a tomb no one's been in 400 years, and there's like a room full of scarecrows, your party's probably going to see what's coming.
But like at the same time, maybe they just don't. Maybe they're just really confused for just long enough that it's funny. Like not saying for.
Oh, I didn't think crows would be a problem down here. Me either. Let's keep moving.
But like, no, seriously, sometimes that like they walk into a room in a dungeon and see like 10 scarecrows, it'd just be like, I don't think we should go through this room. Like, just shut the door or just cast fireball. It doesn't matter. I would love to do that just because it's funny.
Right.
And realistically speaking, if you got the party to use a level 3 spell to take out a room of scarecrows, that's just normal scarecrows. It's not actually... not actually bad scarecrows at all. This is just the wizard resource drain. Now that's an adversarial DM.
A really intelligent in-world dungeon designer.
Yeah. So at first they're going to be confused that they're scarecrows, but then they're going to think that the scarecrows are actually spirits, and then they're just normal scarecrows. Why don't we just make them the evil scarecrows? Like, no, it's too easy.
Well, then the next room is full of the evil scarecrows. And they go, I'm not falling for that again. I'm saving that third level spell slot. They walk in and get swarmed by evil scarecrows.
Everyone fails their terrifying glare save and just gets the crap beaten out of them. One thing this just came to mind of, more the paralyzed condition in general, since it is only for a turn. Strategy to think of that's more interesting than just paralyze and hit them is paralyze them and then have another one come and just tackle them, because the creature automatically fails strength and dex saving throws, and I guess not ability checks. Oh, that's interesting. Paralyzed has no effect on your ability to be grappled.
I think.
Oh, incapacitated.
Grappled if you're incapped.
Incapacitated. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Fucking hate that condition. They just sneak it in there. It's like, oh, you're also incapacitated. So that thing you were going to do, you can't.
Yeah. Can't take actions or reactions. That's it, though. Anyways, I could just see doing that. So when they come back, they're at least knocked prone and still have to deal with getting up, potentially being grappled as well. Right. It's just a good way to dogpile it.
Yeah.
Takes away the wizard wanting to use burning hands because they're going to have to burn their friend too. It's a lot. I like scarecrows.
Yeah. Spooky.
Yeah, they're awesome. The art in the book is really good too.
Yeah. Because
the normal one's like spooky, and then the like extra flavor art above it is just horrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it just has somebody
can't see it
beyond,
but yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
I wish there was actually a boss scarecrow. I don't see one from the official material, but I'm sure some creative soul out there could probably figure it out. Hint, scarecrow filled with other scarecrows. That was a pattern we've seen, and it works.
Ooh, I got one. Like 12-foot tall scarecrow.
Made of little tiny scarecrows. It's going to be great.
I actually don't scarecrow. Know.
Oh my God.
Why?
Just a sack of straw that floats around.
Because it's really effective at scaring crows. I mean, let's be honest.
Just floating through the field, lasering crows.
I actually don't know how I would make this a stronger enemy. Because at some point, if you make it too strong, it loses the scarecrow aspect of like it just being a weak little thing. But I agree with you. Like the art that's above there, it looks like Freddy Krueger is definitely what it immediately comes to for me, but a scarecrow Freddy Krueger.
Yeah.
It's Jack the Pumpkin guy from Nightmare Before Christmas combined with Freddy Krueger.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I see that. So maybe there's a way you just kind of ignore some stuff. I don't know. That's great game design. How do you make that monster?
Just throw all that. Just fuck it, man. I just toss stuff in there. When in doubt, make it huge and fill it with a smaller version of itself.
Right. Make it large. Give it a more frightening, like a frightening cone instead of a specific glare so that it can get multiple people at once. Make its claws a little more deadly.
It should throw pumpkins, probably.
Yeah, you're actually right. It should totally throw pumpkins. They're not like special pumpkins. It's just normal pumpkins that just do bludgeoning damage, like improvised weapons. Now, little pumpkin bombs would be nice, though. Do like some AOE gas. Wait, is this?
He's got like a flying glider.
This is sounding familiar.
And a son who's a relatively famous actor.
All right. Got nothing else. Let's. Are there any other spooky monsters? I think we're done.
I think we're good. Went out for a
we
while.
We knocked
here.
Out a lot. Yeah. This is good.
Yeah.
We gotta do more of these. It's like the Summer of Frogs condensed into one episode.
Yeah. Well, if that's it, thanks for listening.
Next time on Monsters and Multiclass.
Join us as we discuss the Warlock Wizard multiclass and then the Duergar Part 2.